Divorce and Remarriage, the seventh talk in a series titled Understanding Love, Sex, and Marriage, was presented by David Crabtree on November 12, 2002, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Okay, my topic is divorce and remarriage. I am not going to hold you in suspense. I'm going to tell you right up front what I'm going to say, and then I'll go on to say it. What I'm going to argue is that the Bible doesn't give us a set of rules like you would find, for instance, in an IRS pamphlet that tells us in every circumstance what is the right thing to do. Rather, what the Bible does is gives us general principles that we then have to figure out how to apply to a wide variety of circumstances. In this particular case, I think that the principle is quite simple. And the principle with respect to divorce is that we as believers are to be fans of marriage, and that we are to work towards the health of marriages, both our own and of others, with all of our might. And we are to hate divorce because it constitutes the breaking of one of the most sacred of human bonds. I think that's the principle. And I am going to defend that by looking at a couple of passages. I won't have time to go through each of the passages in detail. I am rather going to just sketch out an understanding of them. Then I want to talk about the implications of this particular principle. And then I will open it up for questions, and we can fill it out that way. There are not many passages in the Bible that deal with divorce. There are three passages in the Gospels, and then there's a passage in 1 Corinthians. Divorce is mentioned a couple of times in the Old Testament, but I won't really get into either of those mentions. I would like to begin by looking at the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus addresses the issue of divorce very briefly in the Sermon on the Mount, and I want to take us through the Sermon on the Mount because that is important for what I am going to argue later. Because it's my understanding of Jesus' teaching that it always has an edge to it, in the sense that Jesus is speaking into a cultural situation in which there is a dominant understanding of what it means to be a righteous human being. And Jesus is interacting with that understanding and helping to make clear what he means by righteousness, oftentimes in contrast to the popular understanding of righteousness at the time. So let's look at the Sermon on the Mount in chapter 5 of Matthew. If you have your Bible, if you don't, that's fine. I am not going to go through it verse by verse, but rather I'm just going to outline what I think is happening. And I want to talk about the sermon as a whole, because that's going to be helpful later on when we get to Matthew 19. It is a very interesting sermon, very thought-provoking, and if you haven't looked at it carefully, I would urge you to do so. He starts out with what are called the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth, etc. What is happening in this, in the Beatitudes, I think, is that Jesus is, he realizes that the picture that people have of righteousness is a Pharisee, a good Pharisee. Now, a Pharisee is one who studies the law, takes the law very, very seriously, and tries to conform his life to the strictures in the law. And so a Pharisee is one who is self-assuredly and fervently a follower of the law, even bordering on militantly, a militant defender of the law, and uncompromising in championing the law. Jesus, then, in the Beatitudes, is contrasting that with his picture of righteousness. Rather than this self-assured, fervent defender of the particulars of the law, even to the point of being self-righteous, Jesus' picture is a very different one. It's one who is a spiritual beggar. It's one who realizes that he is spiritually bankrupt and has no spiritual wealth to offer up to God. He is at God's mercy. That is a drastically different picture. It's between this militant champion of the law, self-assured champion of the law, and this spiritual beggar. So the dominant picture that people would conjure up as a Pharisee, the one that Jesus is offering, is a repentant sinner, a repentant publican. Okay, then he goes on to talk about if that's true, if that's what righteousness is, then righteousness is primarily an attitude. Righteousness is primarily inward. It's a perspective on oneself. And he argues that if one is righteous, then it only makes sense that righteousness would be worked out in one's life. That one would have an impact on the world just by living out a life that's inconsistent with that righteousness. And therefore, they will not be a light hidden from the world, but will be a light revealed, seen in the world. Then he moves on, to say that it may appear as though what Jesus has to say in some way undermines the law. Jesus is going to give such a different interpretation to the law that it may look like he's changing the law, or taking away from the law, or undermining the law. And Jesus assures them that is not the case. He has the utmost respect for the law. He has not come to negate anything that's in the law. Rather, he is coming to call people to a higher standard. It is thoroughly in keeping with the law, but it's a higher standard than the way the law is generally interpreted. Then he goes into a series of remarks where he contrasts, "You have heard it said X, but I say to you Y." And there are six of these. And he uses these as a way to show how his interpretation of the law is different from the standard interpretation that people are generally come into contact with. And this is a means by which he's showing that he is fully supportive of the law, but the law is actually calling people to a higher standard. And what he points out in these contrasts is that what is typically done in the surrounding culture is to use the law as a way of justifying doing that which is contrary to the spirit of the law. Using the law itself to hide wickedness, to justify and hide wickedness. And that's what Jesus wants to point out in these contrasts. The first one, and they all go, "You have heard it said, but I say to you." The first one is, you have heard it said, you've heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder. The Old Testament law says, thou shalt not commit murder. And the understanding of that is, if you do not take a gun and shoot someone dead, then you are in compliance with the law with respect to that particular statement. That means, if that's the way we are to understand the law, then that allows a great deal that falls short of murder. And that's what Jesus goes on to point out. He says, whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And whoever shall say to his brother, Raka, which means fool, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever shall say, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go to the fiery hell. If, therefore, you are presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and make present your offering, etc. So Jesus is saying the standard really is that you ought not even have thoughts, murderous thoughts. You ought not call another person a fool. You ought not wish them out of existence. You ought not have those kinds of thoughts at all. The second one, you shall not commit adultery. Under the popular understanding, that means that if someone stops short of sleeping with another man's wife, then they are righteous with respect to this particular part of the law. But Jesus says, if you even look on another woman with lust in your heart, then you have committed adultery. In other words, to even have adulterous desires is a violation of the law. I'm going to skip the third one and come back to it. The fourth one, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. That's what you have heard it said. And apparently, this law was interpreted to mean that if I make a vow in the name of the Lord, then I need to keep that vow. But other vows not made in the name of the Lord, those are lesser vows and vows that I don't need to follow through on. So it's an escape clause in a sense. I can make vows that I don't have to be held to as long as I don't make them in the name of the Lord. I can make them in lesser things. And the lesser thing that I take my vow in the name of, the less binding it is on me. And his response to that is, Jesus says, but I say to you, let your yes be yes and your no be no. In other words, your vows are binding. There aren't various degrees of vows, but vows are binding. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. The next one, he says, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That was drawn from the Old Testament law, and apparently this was used in the popular understanding to mean that that revenge is justified. If someone harms me, I can do the same harm back to them. And Jesus is saying, but I say to you. Now, Jesus, I suspect, he doesn't explain this, but I suspect Jesus would argue that statement, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, was never meant to justify revenge in interpersonal relations. That, in the Old Testament, was merely a gauge by which social justice could be determined. That a crime ought to be punished in proportion to the damage that is done. If an eye gets taken, then the punishment on the evildoer ought to be comparable. So it's a principle of social justice rather than a principle of interpersonal relations. Jesus says, "But I say to you, turn your other cheek. If someone strikes you on the cheek, you turn the other cheek." In other words, vengeance is not justified in interpersonal relations. If someone wrongs you, then turn the other cheek rather than taking vengeance. And the last one, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor. Apparently, this then, in the popular understanding, was taken to mean that you need to love your neighbor, but you can hate everyone else. So all you need to do is define neighbor well, and you can hate whoever you choose. So this commandment to love your neighbor became a justification for hating others. And Jesus' corrective to this is, I say to you, love your enemies. That is, love all of the people that you encounter, not just those that qualify under your technical definition of neighbor. The interesting thing here is, in each case, what the popular understanding has done is it has approached these commandments as loopholes. It has approached these commandments with the perspective, what will this allow me to do? What can I get away with and be in keeping with these commandments? What Jesus is doing is appealing to them to have a whole different perspective on the law. That is, to embrace the law. To see the law as a guide, as a faithful guide to understanding what God values and what he does not value. And take on the project of looking at the law to help us understand what is it that God does value. To scour the law for clues of what's God's understanding of what is good and what is evil, what is valuable and what is not valuable, what is helpful and what is detrimental. And then to embrace that, rather than looking to the law in order to find escape clauses and loopholes. Ways of doing what we want to do and yet be justified in doing so. Okay, I omitted one of the comparisons that he makes. We'll come back to that now because that's the one having to do with divorce. He says, "Whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce." In the popular understanding, this particular sentence from the Old Testament was used as a justification for divorce. If there is this provision in the Old Testament law, then divorce must be permissible. That was the popular understanding. "But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the cause of unchastity, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery." What Jesus is pointing out is that divorce is very adultery-like. Now let me explain how I think these words add up to that. And it is difficult, because where it says, makes her commit adultery, that is a word that appears nowhere else in the New Testament, and it does not appear very often in Greek, in any of the Greek writings. It appears, that word is a verb, and it appears in the passive voice only about a dozen times in all of classical Greek literature. And it will take a little bit of explaining for me to help you to understand what I think that this word means. In Greek culture, I have to explain some Greek culture in order for you to understand this Greek word. In Greek culture, marriage, the primary purpose of marriage, the primary goal in marriage, socially, was the production of legitimate children. So in Greek culture, it was very, very important, for instance, that a married woman never be caught committing adultery. Because if a married woman commits adultery, then the paternity of any child born to that marriage is in question. The maternity of a child is always clear. It's the paternity of a child that's in question. So in Greek culture, the thinking was, if we make sure that a married woman never messes around, then parentage is clear. Then we know who the parents of a child are. An implication of that was, in Greek culture, married men could have affairs on the side, as long as they were discreet and didn't have affairs with married women. So the word that means adultery in Greek is similar to our word in English. To adulterate means to corrupt. The problem with adultery is it corrupted the parentage. It made unclear the parentage. Here we have the passive voice of that verb. So what it is saying is, I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, I'll leave out the except clause, adulterates her. If you divorce your wife, you are adulterating her. In other words, if you divorce your wife, you are treating that relationship as if she were just a live-in, as if she were just a mistress, as if she were never your wife at all. And that's adultery. Even the Pharisees would say that's wrong. So that's the first part. If you divorce your wife, you adulterate her. You're treating her as a mistress. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Here is the other part of it. What if I somehow am involved in encouraging a divorce over here? There's a woman that I am very interested in. The problem is she's married. If I engineer a divorce here, then I'm free to marry her, am I not? Under the popular understanding, that would be absolutely fine. And Jesus' perspective is, what makes that right? In fact, what makes that different from adultery? It is just legalized adultery. You've gone through a few legal hoops, but it is essentially the same thing as adultery. So to divorce your wife is adulterous, or to marry someone that you have just encouraged to get a divorce, both of those are clearly adulterous. So what you've done is you've taken the provision for divorce and used that to justify adulterous kinds of activities. That's his point. Okay. I think that that's what he's making clear. That's his project throughout, is to show them the contrast between how it is popularly understood, these parts of the law, and how that falls short of the spirit of the law itself. That those are really just dodges to justify wickedness. And with respect to divorce, they have interpreted divorce, the provisions for divorce, in such a way that it has just become a legalization of adulterous actions. Now, I left out the clause, except for the cause of unchastity. We will come back to that after we look at it, after we've looked at the passage in Matthew 19. So let's turn to that, Matthew 19. Matthew 19, it has a passage, the passage where Jesus is interacting with the Pharisees on the question of divorce. There is a parallel passage in Mark 10, but I'll look at Matthew 19 primarily. Now, it was not uncommon for the Pharisees to come to Jesus and ask him some leading question, some kind of question that was really designed to get Jesus into trouble. And it's important to understand that. They aren't coming out of a sincere desire to know the answer to their question. They aren't coming, "Jesus, I really want to know, what do you think about divorce?" They are coming to try to lay a trap for him. And what they do this a number of times in the gospel accounts. They come to Jesus with some kind of question that is designed to alienate a significant portion of his audience, one way or another. They ask him this leading question, and they want him to answer in a way that will be that will get him into trouble. What Jesus does in every case where this happens is he does not give an elaborate answer to their question. He either gives a brief answer to their question and then does the next step, or he moves right to the next step. And the next step is he takes their own beliefs and shows how those beliefs of the questioners are incompatible with the spirit of the law itself. In other words, he turns the issue back on the questioners and shows that they are hypocrites. He does that consistently, and I will argue that that's what he does here as well. Here is the question that they come with. They say to him, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause at all?" Now, I think the question here is they're just posing a question that was common at the time of Jesus. There was a debate between, there are two rabbis who have had enjoyed a great deal of respect in Jewish culture at the time. One of them is Hillel and one is Shammai. And they had different perspectives on divorce. Hillel had argued that divorce was permissible for any cause whatsoever. He even goes so far as to argue that if a wife spoils a meal, that is grounds for divorce. Shammai, on the other hand, had argued that the only basis for divorce is if one's wife has committed adultery. So this was a current topic of debate at the time of Jesus. And so they are coming to him and asking him, "What do you think about this?" It would be much like someone coming, if Jesus were here today, coming to him and say, "Do you believe in a woman's right to choose?" It's not because they want to know, it's because they want to get the person in trouble. And that's what they're doing in this particular instance. Jesus' answer is, and this, he gives more of an answer here than he generally does, but it's not a full exposition. He's not really responding to them as if they want to know. He gives a brief presentation of his perspective and then leaves it at that, and they respond to what he says. His response is essentially this. Marriage was part of God's plan from the very beginning. Marriage was instituted by God. It is a good thing. And it was instituted by God. And by the way, it is instituted immediately after the creation of man. It was instituted to solve a problem. What was the problem that it was instituted to solve? It was to solve man's loneliness, his aloneness. And the way that it solves it is God is saying a man and woman come together in marriage to form a partnership, a permanent partnership. And when they come together in marriage, their lives are joined and they take on a sacred obligation before God. And since they take on a sacred obligation before God, no human being and no human institution has the authority to sever that bond. God has not given anyone such authority. And therefore, they do not have that authority. Okay, that is essentially his response. The Pharisees then come back and they say, well then, why does the Old Testament have provision for divorce? Yes, in the Old Testament there is provision for divorce, and they're saying, why is that there? If there is no authority for severing that bond of marriage. And Jesus' response is, because people are sinners. People are sinners, and where the people are sinners, they are not going to be able to live with that standard. There are going to be marriages in which people will insist, one way or another, will insist in being released from that bond. And it will be so less socially disruptive to have some provision to make that possible than to insist that they stay in that relationship. So the provision for divorce is there only because of man's rebelliousness and man's wickedness. It doesn't make divorce a righteous act. It just means that it is necessary for social order in some cases. Jesus then goes on, and I think here is where he's turning it back on them and showing their hypocrisy. What he says is, in verse 9, and I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for immorality, and marries another woman, commits adultery. So he's saying, if you divorce your wife and marry someone else, is that not the same thing as adultery, just legalized? The only thing that separates that from adultery is you've gone through the legal hoops, just as he was saying earlier in the Sermon on the Mount. Your understanding of divorce merely legalizes adultery. It's just a dodge that makes it possible for you to do adulterous things and feel good about yourself and still continue to think that you're righteous. Okay. Now, for the exception. I have skipped the exception here again, so we'll come back to it. It's a similar kind of statement. It says, except for immorality. Now, why would Jesus put that in there? Because earlier, in his statement of what marriage is, there was no room for an exception. His statement of what marriage is, there's no authorization. No one can break marriage. So where does this exception come in? I think that the answer is that it's not really an exception. And I think that this is the logic behind it. He has included this. I'll come back to that. I think this is the logic behind it. In Jewish culture, it was not possible for women to get a divorce. Only men could get a divorce. So what would a woman do if she were determined that she would no longer be a part of a marriage? Well, she would leave. She'd just leave the marriage, go to another man probably, because it's difficult to live as a woman alone in those times. So essentially what her alternative, her way of committing divorce, it would be to commit fornication or to go and live with someone else outside of marriage. And what Jesus, I think, is saying here is, in that case, if a woman has gone elsewhere, then a divorce makes sense because one person can't be married. One person a marriage does not make. There's just that just makes sense that in marriage it is our obligation, it is our duty to do everything that we can to work towards the health and well-being of that marriage. But if the other person is determined to not be a part of the marriage, there's nothing more that can be done. If the other person leaves, goes to New York, what are you going to do to work towards the health and welfare of that marriage? At some point, there's nothing more that can be done. And I think that this clause is just a recognition of that fact. That if the wife has opted out, then divorce makes sense. It is permissible in a sense. Okay, let's look at the parallel passage in Mark. It states it a little differently there. It's Mark 10, verse 11. And here what Jesus says is, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she herself divorces her husband and marries another man, she is committing adultery. Why the difference? I think that they are both saying essentially the same thing, but they are putting it in different terms because they are directed towards different cultures. What are the differences? In Greek culture, both men and women could get divorces. In Greek culture, therefore, a woman has that option available to them. That's one difference. The other difference is, in Jewish culture, I'm going to go back to Jewish culture. In Jewish culture, as I said before, women could not get divorces. Another aspect of Jewish culture is the Old Testament law is addressed to men consistently. If you read through the Old Testament law, it is addressed to men. The assumption is that the men then will go and teach it to their households. When Jesus is teaching in Matthew, there too it's as if it is addressed to men. In Greek culture, that would not have been as mandatory. You could address both men and women. There are several indications in Mark that Mark was addressed with a Gentile audience in mind. There are several places where Mark explains Jewish customs and in which he translates names into Greek for a Greek audience. So I think what we have in Mark is the same principle is being proclaimed to a Greek audience. And therefore, what he says is, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. That's essentially what was said in Matthew. If you divorce and marry someone else, that's adultery. How is that different? Aren't those essentially the same? And if she herself divorces her husband and marries another man, she is committing adultery. So now he's turning to the women and saying, if a woman divorces and marries a man, that too is adultery. It's the same thing. So I think the principle is the same in both cases. That divorce, in the popular understanding at the time, had been used as a way of legalizing adulterous desires. And the Pharisees had essentially espoused that. And what Jesus is pointing out is that God is not fooled. Just because you go through the legal hurdles it doesn't mean that you have substantially changed the act. That the divorce, and then so that you can marry someone else, is just carrying through with adulterous desire. Okay. Now let's look at 1 Corinthians 7. This is a very difficult passage. And it's a long passage. So I'm going to go through it. I'm just going to sketch it out. I'm not really going to go through it verse by verse. The background here is apparently a situation in which the Corinthians have written a series of questions to Paul, and Paul is responding to those questions. We don't know what those questions are. We don't have a list of those questions. But to a certain extent, you can determine what the questions were from the answers that Paul gives. And Paul is apparently addressing a situation in which it is commonly understood among the Corinthians that there is something less than spiritual about having sexual relations. So they have written to Paul and they've said, is it good to never have sexual relations? And Paul then is going to respond to that. And his response is going to be essentially, and the Corinthians, in many cases, these are Corinthians who are married. So people who are married are asking, is it not better for people to never engage, to not engage in sexual relations? Isn't there something more spiritual, more holy about that? And Paul's response is going to be, it is fine to not have sexual relations, but sexual relations are a part of marriage. And those are the principles that he's going to draw upon as he responds to different parts of his audience. People who are married, people who are widows or widowers, and people who are engaged. Marriage relationship, it's part of what happens in marriage. It's a part of becoming one. And in the absence of sexual relations, then the temptations for straying elsewhere are too great. He goes on to say that temporary cessation from sexual relations is okay. That's fine. If it is by mutual agreement, as long as it is temporary, that then you come back together and restore normal sexual relations. Then in verse 8, he turns to those who are widows. And Ron recently taught through this passage at Reformation Fellowship. And I suspect that he is right when he takes unmarried here to mean widowers. So here he's addressing widows and widowers. And what he says is, it's better not to marry. You are widows and widowers. It would be better for you not to marry because there are advantages. And he goes on to talk about that at greater length later on in the chapter. But it is not wrong to marry. Then he gets around to this whole presentation is a little bit, Paul's presentation is a little bit rambling, so it allows me to be a little bit rambling. He gives the general principle then, I think, of what Jesus had to say with respect to divorce. And we find that in verse 12. But to the rest I say, not the Lord. Whoops, I'm sorry. I don't mean that. Verse 10. But to the married I give instructions, not I, but the Lord. So I think what he's saying there is, this is what Jesus had to teach on the topic. That the wife should not leave her husband, and then there's a parenthetical remark, and that the husband should not send his wife away. So that's his general principle, is that you should not separate. If you're married, do not separate. Then he puts in the parentheses, but if she does leave, that is, if they do separate for And I think what he has in mind here is religious reasons. Separate in order to break off sexual relations, if that's the reason for it. Then certainly let her remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. So I think his statement there is, if they should separate, it should only be temporary and with an eye to returning, with a view to returning, a temporary state. And she should definitely not marry again, and make that separation permanent. Then he goes into a discussion of if someone has an unbelieving spouse. And his principle there is basically, if your unbelieving spouse consents to be married to you, then that there's nothing that being married to an unbelieving spouse does to ruin you and your relationship to God or spoil your children in some way. That it is okay. There's nothing inherently unholy about being married to an unbelieving spouse. Therefore, if your spouse consents to living with you, then continue that marriage. However, if your spouse is adamant they do not want to be married to you, then divorce is permissible. Okay, then he goes into an extended discussion of the principle that people should stay in the condition in which they have been called. Whatever condition you find yourself in, then stay in that condition. Becoming a Christian doesn't change your requirement to stay, the propriety of staying in that condition. He talks about, are you circumcised? Are you uncircumcised? That really does not make any difference with respect to your relationship with God. Stay as you were when you were called. Same thing, slave. If you're a slave or you are free, stay in the condition in which you were called. If you have the opportunity to become free, that's just fine. But his principle there is stay in the condition in which you were called. That has application to those who are married to unbelievers. Okay, the last section then he talks to those who are unmarried, and I think what is intended here is those who are engaged. And the principle there is, and I will make this much shorter. Basically what he says, if you're engaged and you want to marry, you feel driven to be married, then go ahead. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you're engaged and you don't feel driven to be married, you don't feel an urgency to be married, then it's fine to not marry. Either way is fine. And then at the very end, I'll skip down to the very end, if he says a wife is bound as long as her husband lives, but if her husband is dead, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. So the marriage, if someone is married, they are obligated to stay married. If their spouse has died, then they are free to marry someone else. Okay. Let me try to summarize, I think, what the principles are there in this passage. His overall perspective is marriage is a good thing. Marriage is good and proper. And sexual relations are a good and proper part of marriage and ought to be a good and proper part of marriage. So if you are married, then stay married. There is nothing less spiritual about staying married. In fact, you have an obligation to stay married. However, you ought to maintain normal sexual relations because that's part of marriage. That's good and proper. If you are not married, then don't marry. There are significant advantages to not being married. And Paul, as one who is not married, understands those advantages and I suspect has even talked about those advantages when he was there present with the Corinthians. And in this chapter, he goes into that to a certain extent. There's a great freedom in not being married. There are fewer burdens, and it allows one to be focused on other things. However, there is absolutely nothing wrong with being married. So if you are unmarried and you choose to be married, there's nothing wrong with that. If you are married to an unbeliever, stay married as long as your spouse consents to that. But if your spouse insists, no, I do not want to be married, I will not be married to you, then let them go. So I think that's essentially what he's saying in this chapter, and that dovetails with what he had said in the two gospel passages, the three gospel passages. Let me then try to summarize, restate what I think the principle is, and summarize how I think that is to be played out. As I said before, we are to be fans of marriage. Marriage is a sacred institution instituted by God, and when we get married, we take on an obligation before God that we have chosen to become one with this other person, create a permanent bond. So every married person takes on a God-given responsibility to work towards the health of that marriage. So our job then is to do everything that we can to foster oneness and health in that marriage. We are to keep marriage in the right perspective. We need to guard against the perspective that says, under what conditions can I get a divorce? We aren't to be looking for loopholes. We aren't looking for escape clauses. Our attitude should constantly be, what can I do to encourage and foster health in my marriage? Is there more that I could do to make this marriage healthier? However, given the wickedness of man, no matter how much we might try and work towards creating health in our marriage, marriages can and do go bad. Marriages can and do break up. We ought do nothing to contribute to that. But if it happens, if our spouse is determined that he or she will no longer be a part of this marriage, then divorce is permissible. How do we know when that happens? How do we know that our spouse has made that choice? That's a very difficult decision. If they go down and file papers, that may be an indication. If they commit adultery, that may be an indication. If there is abuse, that may be an indication. What's tricky about it, however, is we as human beings are complicated. And in none of those cases is it determinative. So there's more that has to go into making that choice. However, if it happens that our spouse refuses to be a part of a marriage, then divorce is permissible. Regrettable, but permissible. When is remarriage possible and permitted? I think that the biblical perspective is quite simple on that. If we find ourselves unmarried, and that state is, we are unmarried, and that is a resolved situation, then we are free to marry. Reconciliation is a noble thing. It's something worth working towards in strained relationships. But if a relationship is completely severed, then remarriage is permissible. Okay, I think that's basically the biblical perspective. On the one hand, it's nice because it's so simple. On the other hand, it's unfortunate because it's so difficult. Well, let me explain what I mean by that. I'm convinced that God did not choose to give us directions on how to live life. He could have given us minute directions that would tell us what to do in all kinds of circumstances, like the IRS tries to do in its pamphlets, so that we would know in every situation what we ought to do. God has obviously elected not to do it that. God has not provided us with that kind of information. What God has done instead is to give us general principles which give us a certain amount of direction, but we have to figure out how they apply to any particular set of circumstances. And that is oftentimes extremely difficult. But God has made that choice, and I think it is a... we need to take into account that choice that God has made. What He has chosen is to make it more difficult for us to get all of our decisions right. We are going to make a lot of mistakes when we're operating on the basis of principles. But there is the advantage of every time we make one of these choices, we have to agonize over it and wrestle with it and come to terms with, what is it that I want? What is it that's driving me? Am I just looking for an excuse to get out of this marriage? Or am I looking at it even-handedly, sanely, reasonably, and making a wise determination of the situation and therefore how I should act? And there is a great deal of educational value that comes from that. We end up making those principles our own in a way that we never make IRS rules our own. You just blindly follow them. It doesn't require you to take those in and work with them and really come to understand them and decide time and time again, I embrace these principles and I want them to be the principles on which I live my life. So what God has done is He's given us principles that are, for the most part, fairly simple, but very difficult of application. However, they are principles that can be applied to a wide variety of circumstances if we have the wisdom. And that's what we have to gain the wisdom to do. I think it's clear that God's emphasis is not on helping, making sure that we get every choice right. He wants us to internalize His principles and come to love what He loves and value what He values. And what He values is He does value marriage. Marriage is something that is worth working hard at, taking very seriously and doing everything we can to bring health to our marriage as well as all marriages around us. We should be fans of marriage. We should hate divorce, because divorce is breaking of a bond, a sacred bond, one that was intended to be permanent, and one that we have a duty before God to maintain. But if we understand who we are and our propensity to sin and rebelliousness, and if we understand the difficulty of living life according to God's principles, we really have no choice but to be understanding, forgiving, and tolerant of other people as they wrestle with their decisions as to whether they are supposed to, whether they are in a situation where they need to get a divorce or not, or if they have divorced, or whatever. There are all kinds of complex situations that develop in marriages. And we need to be understanding and tolerant and patient towards people as they work through those and as they have worked through those and are living out the aftermath of those. Okay. What I would like to do is throw it open now for questions to fill out what I have only talked about in general terms.
I have two questions. The first has to do with you briefly mentioned abusive relationships and that may be an indication that the person wants to leave. And I'm trying to figure out, from earliest childhood, I've always been taught that if there's an abusive relationship, you want to get out of it. You want to get away from it instead of just letting yourself stay there and get beat up. So then when will there be an abusive relationship that you don't take it as an indication that the person wants to leave?
Yeah. Good question. I have not counseled with a lot of people in marital problems. I have a few couples, but not a lot. I'm sure there are others here who have counseled a lot more people than I have in those kinds of situations. However, I have interacted with people enough, and I have lived in my own head long enough to know that people are very complex. So I think it seems to me that it would be true that there are abusive relationships and there are abusive relationships. And what I mean by that is there are abusive relationships in which the person does not want to be abusive and really does want to work things out with their spouse, but are having difficulty doing so. I would put that in a different category from someone who is abusive and there is none of that. They may want to stay legally married, but I think that there are marriages that are legally marriages that are not really a relationship in which oneness is in view whatsoever. So I think that there can be abusive relationships in which the other person does not want to work towards oneness whatsoever. They may want to stay married, they may want to stay in a legal relationship, but they don't want to work towards oneness whatsoever. And if that is the situation, then divorce might very well be the right thing to do.
Then along the same lines, what about adultery?
That would be a similar kind of situation, that there is adultery and then there's adultery. There is adultery in which the driving force behind it is, I want to be out of this relationship. It's old, it's stale, it's confiding, whatever. And there's no real desire to work towards oneness at all. If that's the case, then divorce might be the right thing. But there are other instances in which someone will commit adultery, but deep down in, what they would like to do is be reconciled with their spouse. There are other things going on. And if that's the case, I think that it would actually be wrong to get a divorce. Now, if that happens, that makes reconciliation extremely difficult. That's understandable. But if that's the situation, I think ultimately it would be wrong to get a divorce.
Okay, then my last question,
is three, you said two.
Sorry. Third and final, I hope, question is, you briefly, very briefly talked about a Christian and a non-Christian spouse. And I've often heard pastors refer to that as, well, this was a period when a lot of people were becoming Christians, and if they're already married, then they should stay married. What are the implications of dating or becoming engaged to someone that's not a Christian? I mean, is there any biblical thought on how to address that?
Well, there are other passages in Scripture, I think, that make it clear that, and common sense would tell us, I think, that if you are a believer, you should only marry another believer. If you just think about marriage and what marriage is the merging of two lives. That means if two lives are coming together and merging, then there are decisions that have to be made. And decisions that have to be made sooner or later always involve values, what's important and what's not important. And there has to be purpose and direction in a marriage. There has to be a common understanding of what life is all about. If you don't have a common understanding of basic values and what life is all about, you're in for an enormous amount of problems. I mean, right from the get-go, you're headed in different directions. How are you going to bring oneness to that? So on the most fundamental of issues, if there's not agreement, then how are you going to build oneness? So I think the biblical perspective is pretty clear that if you are a believer, you shouldn't even entertain thoughts of marrying a non-believer. It makes no sense. But if you are a believer who, for whatever reason, and there could be a variety of reasons, you find yourself married to an unbeliever, then stay married. If they're willing to stay married to you, then stay married. Yes, you're going, there's a sense in which you're going in fundamentally different directions. But you're in this relationship. You're in this condition. Remain in this condition. The only reason that you would not is if your spouse says, no way, I refuse to be married to a Christian, I'm out of here. Or it doesn't have to be that reason, it could be any other reason. I'm just out of here. Then let them go.
I just thought I'd throw in another 2 cents. I really appreciate what you were saying about the principles and that every situation is very complex. And Valerie's questions really raise that. There's abuse and then there's abuse. There's adultery and then there's adultery. And I like the way you've distinguished those. I think another piece of that is that we really want categories really bad for, and we want kind of rules to say, if it's like this, then we do this. And so the application of these principles that you're talking about gets very difficult, and I think it's very individual. So the couples that I've worked with have fit into a variety of those categories, and there's just not good ways to say, this is what you do in this case, this is what you do in that case. I think it's certainly appropriate to hold people accountable for when they are not being responsible. If someone is physically violent in particular, that there are steps that protect the safety of the people involved. It's kind of commonsensical that way. And so there's a lot that you can do short of divorce while you're finding out which kind of abuse it is and whether or not the offending party is willing to find other ways to express themselves. The other part of that is I think we also tend to think in categories of victims and perpetrators, and I think that those categories can be really misleading, because when it comes right down to it, we're all abusive on some level. I mean, we hurt each other, and there's no good guys and bad guys in a lot of situations. Now, I would say that when it comes to be that there's a commitment on someone's part to doing what's not right, that's pretty clearly not someone who's pursuing wisdom in the same way that I would want to be. That makes sense? That I mean, there's a line there. Mm-hmm. But I just think that we're really messy, and there aren't real clear lines. And we can kind of make ourselves into victims rather than looking at our own part. And I think it's always really vital for both partners to look at the contributions that they make.
I hope to frame this correctly, but it comes to the point, And I'm remembering your paper on this that you did several years ago, but I'm not remembering very much. But you touched on it tonight.
That's fine.
About you could call it a severed relationship or a dead marriage. There's death has happened in the relationship. And I remember when I first read your paper that it left a lot more room for divorce than Christianity as a culture in my exposure to it had left. And my question has to do with the bar. And I know it has to do with what Nancy was saying, how complex human beings are. But the bar can be, it seems to be, we want specifics, but it seems to be that as two human beings are in a relationship, one person could say, this is a dead marriage, because they feel like their needs aren't being met or whatever, for whatever reason, and the other person could wake up and say, well, I'm okay with it, you know.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
Yes. Well, it is unavoidable that there's a lot of judgment and soul searching that goes into determining whether a marriage is dead, that is, that the relationship is there, that, and it should, if we look at the marriage and we say it's dead, and it's because I have stopped caring, there's no question what my course of action ought to be. I mean, I need to change my attitude. I need to look at this differently. If I look at it and I say, my spouse has opted out of the marriage, they are psychologically gone from this marriage, that I think that can happen. But I have to look at that and I have to say, is that my judgment based on the fact that I want an excuse to get out of this? Or is that my judgment on the basis of the way things really are? There's a lot of soul searching that has to go on in making those kinds of assessments. Even in something like abuse, am I looking at things the way they really are? Or am I using some abuse as an excuse to get out of an uncomfortable situation? A marriage that's difficult, a marriage that's messy. If I'm just using an excuse to get out of it, I need to change my attitude towards it. I should never be the one that is the cause for the severance of the relationship, of the relationship itself. I'm not talking about who files papers. That's a completely different issue. But I should never be the cause. I should always fight for the oneness in the marriage right down to the bitter end. And if I am looking for ways to get out of this thing, then that's adulterous. That's wrong. I should only be looking for ways to keep this thing together until there's nothing left to keep together. So raising the bar, lowering the bar, it seems to me there's a sense in which it's just seeing things differently such that we have, the question is, what's going on in your soul? What is it that you really want? And what I really should want is that which God wants, embracing His values. And He is a fan of marriage, and I ought to be a fan of marriage and work as hard as I can to maintain that and be on the guard against anything that detracts me from that mission. Is that an answer?
It's a big question.
But we come into that. It's not just in divorce. Any issue. You can lay down guidelines that would, in a sense, preserve right behavior to a higher degree. But what I'm convinced of is God is not as concerned about right behavior. He's willing to allow us to make a lot of mistakes and misjudgments bad judgments. Because in doing so, we work through and wrestle with a lot of issues and internalize some principles in a way that we never would otherwise. There's something that came up in staff meeting last week that I thought was interesting. We were talking about the effect of being in the military on soldiers, people who have been in the military. What kind of impact does that environment have on them? And there's a situation in which they are told everything to do. And if they don't do it, they get punished. So there's a lot of discipline there. And I forget, someone made the observation, well, wouldn't someone who's been in the military be disciplined? And Larry, who has actually been in the military, said, no, not necessarily. Because the discipline is all external. There's nothing that causes you to internalize that discipline. So that it's a part of you. Well, that's an interesting observation because I think that's similar to what God's doing. Rather than giving us a bunch of rules that you just follow, He's given us these principles that we have to make part of ourselves. We have to say, I really want to know what those principles are, and I really want to act on them. I want to live my life according to those principles. Now, how would that work itself out? So we have to internalize those, and they become a part of us in a way that they would never become a part of us if they were just external rules that we follow. So that's the trade-off that God has made. His interest is in us internalizing those rules rather than us doing right actions, getting more actions right, decisions right. He's laid the field wide open for us to make lots of mistakes, and we all do. But we gain in that process.
I have the fear that I'm going to step in real deep here and wish that I'd not taken the microphone, but mm-hmm. I'll be a fool who rushes in.
Okay.
I have a sense that I think I understand the distinction you're making about the external rules versus internalizing the principles. But I have a sense that a byproduct of this is that we lay a tremendously heavy burden on an individual, and I'm trying to decide how to resolve this. For example, a woman marries a man, and shortly into the marriage, she finds out he's a big lout, and he's interested in himself and preoccupied, chauvinistic, and self-centered, and so forth. If she has in her mind the 1 Peter 3 kind of idea that she, by a very determined effort on her part in the presence of her Lord, will do her best to win him over, and approaches it, and in fact cries out to God in such a way for the sake of seeing this become a real marriage and grow into that, that's a commendable thing. If in the back of her mind, as a human being, and I guess this is the realm in which the struggle comes in, if in the back of her mind the idea is there that when he indicates that he doesn't want to be married anymore, then the door is open to be out, does that not become a tremendously heavy burden for her to keep her attention in the direction of righteous approach, righteous principles? Doesn't there enter in a tremendous struggle of soul here now, because the door is cracked open at least, and my eyes continually go over there, and if he'll just right. indicate he doesn't want to be here anymore, yeah. we're done.
Right.
And so right. it seems to me like a very heavy burden that ends up being laid upon her.
I agree. I think that's absolutely true. And unfortunately, I don't think I can remove that burden. You know, I think that's the burden that God has placed there. And it's that's just something that we have to wrestle with and work with. That to be in that situation and still be a fan of marriage and not look for some kind of escape and to have the strength to stay in there and be faithful to that duty, that's a gift from God. That's truly a gift from God. And so I think that the right thing is, in that case, for someone to hang in there. But what if they choose to get a divorce? I can't be anything but understanding. I may decide, I may think that they did the wrong thing. I may even tell them that I think they did the wrong thing. But how can we be anything but understanding? Because if I were in the same situation, I would probably do the same thing. It's a huge burden. God knows it's a huge burden. But what we have to count on is that God will provide us the grace to do what we need to do.
I think we're out of time, but I just wanted to throw in there at the end of that Matthew passage, at the end of that last question, I was thinking of the response of the disciples when they say,
yeah,
if that's the case, then who would marry or
right,
who could marry?
Right.
And
right,
it's like they got it.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Right, right. I mean, there are so many things that in our lives that clearly we can only do by the grace of God. God puts us in all kinds of situations where to act righteously in that situation obviously can only be done by the grace of God. We have to rely upon Him to provide us with the strength and the wisdom to do what's right. Okay? Thanks.